The viewpoints expressed in the following program are not necessarily those of WRUU, its license holder, or its staff. The following program contains subject matter and realistic language that some listeners may find objectionable. Listener discretion is advised. Well, good afternoon, Savannah. It is just past 12 o'clock on this Friday, and that means you're now listening to Literature with Lee and PT. PT, today we have a selection of short stories from some very well-known authors, but these might be stories that people have read or stories that people have just not come across.
They are. To me, the whole charm of the show is going to be that the short stories are so different from each other.
They are so different from each other. At the same time, though, PT, I think there is a common thread.
Ah.
Each of these stories speaks to some fundamental aspect of what it means to be human and really kind of grapples with that fundamental aspect, but in a sometimes a subtle way. And these stories oftentimes leave it up to the listener to determine what we're going to do with the ideas that are presented here. So the three stories we have a short story by Kurt Vonnegut called The Big Up Yonder.
Right.
A story by Chekhov called The Bet.
Right.
And a short story that's a little bit longer than the first two.
Yeah.
By Fitzgerald called The Jelly Bean.
Yes. Right. And a somewhat self-referential one, too.
Yes, a very self-referential one. And we'll really kind of talk about, once we get to Fitzgerald's piece, sort of the packaging that he put this story and other stories in.
Because he
really sort of framed all of these stories that came in this collection. And sometimes scholars are far more interested in the framing than in the stories themselves. But that might be stating things a bit too far. But they're as interested in the framing.
No, I think I've seen that happen once or twice, maybe more.
Right, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So should we start with Vonnegut?
Why don't we? This is a very, very early Vonnegut. It was published in 1954. And it was published in Galaxy Science Fiction magazine. So this is one of those things that you do and have fun with, and not necessarily be terribly profound, but you have fun with it and make a couple of subtle points.
Right. I think there is some things that are profound. You're right, they are subtle points, but, you know, Vonnegut, there's been quite a bit written about Vonnegut's sense of humor. And, you know, his sense of humor was, some people call it kind of a bittersweet humor, sort of a sociocultural commentary type of humor. And you get some of his humor in the story, even though it's not,
roll
on the floor type of humor.
But anybody expecting to find Billy Pilgrim in the story is going to
be looking quite hard. That's right. Now, this is actually a science fiction story in the fact that it is set in the future in 2185.
Yes.
At a time when, and I love this is from just the second paragraph or the third paragraph, however you want to count them. About this family, the Ford family, and a couple of the members of this family, Emerald and Lou, coming in from the balcony where they had been seeking that 2185 rarity, privacy. I think some of us kind of know a little bit about that right now.
Well, actually, we're in kind of a phase going the other way. It's a little difficult to find a whole lot of people right now. There are people sitting in their broom closets or something.
Right, but if you have a lot of family members like the Ford family does,
yes,
you can't get any privacy in your home.
That is certainly true if everybody's home.
Right.
The gimmick to this story is the Fords and everybody else have become overpopulated because the birth rate has continued, and there's this marvelous old new drug that keeps people going for better than twice their lifespans. Gramps Ford in this movie is 172 years old.
Right. And
still going strong.
And still going strong. Now, and unfortunately for him, when this newfangled drug was discovered, he was already sort of aged, and so he has his wrinkles.
So he looks, yeah.
He looks a little old, but he doesn't look as old as
he really is.
Whereas his children's generation and grandchildren's and great-grandchildren, they all tend to look right around the same age because they've been on this magical drug for their lives.
And they look in their 30s or 40s, even though they're somewhere in their hundreds. The other thing that struck me right away is in 2185, they're watching 5-foot television screens. And apparently technology has caught up with us little more rapidly than Vonnegut.
We're a little ahead of time. And the shows that they're watching are in their, you know, umpteenth and then some episode. The shows keep going and going because what do all these people need? They need content. But what's really lacking in the Ford family's apartment is the bedrooms. Only Gramps has a bedroom. Everyone else is relegated to sleeping bags in the hallway or in the living. There's a day bed in the living room. And of course, no member of the Ford family wants the dreaded location, and that is the sleeping bag by the bathroom. Right. Reading this, PT, it makes me think of, you know, when you're on an airplane flight, the last seat you want is the one next to the bathroom. Yeah. Yeah. So I think Vonnegut, you know, crafted that just perfectly.
Now, I think it'd help, Lee, if you count the people who are living in this apartment.
Yes.
We're dealing with something a little over 20, I believe.
Right.
So this is a critical need.
This is a critical need.
Privacy.
Right. And the youngest members of this family, later on in the story, you know, really push back against their elders, saying, hey, look, you know, at least you people had some privacy. You grew up in an era where you might have had a little bit of privacy. We have been born and raised in this era where there is no private. We've never had a bed to ourselves. We've never had a private moment to ourselves. It's always been overpopulated and overcrowded.
Right.
And later in the story, PT, there is a little nod to Schenectady, New York. And if I have this correct, PT, now, Vonnegut, of course, worked for GE in one of its labs as a PR person, right, for a little while. And I believe he worked in Schenectady.
A lot of GE did.
Right. And so, woven into the story is also a little bit of Vonnegut's humor. I think poking fun and also making a social comment on, you know, technology and the technology that he was in the midst of.
Yeah. And in the midst of all this wonderful technology, people travel down well-traveled paths. They remain almost doggedly the same. The same concerns, the same ways of reacting people as people did before.
Right.
And this is something that he actually makes specific. An announcer or somebody says that human evolution hasn't kept up with the evolution of technology.
Yes, this is one of my favorite excerpts from the story. A commentator who is coming over the airwaves. This is Dr. Brainerd Keyes Bullard, continued the commentator, president of Wyandotte College, said in an address tonight that most of the world's ills can be traced to the fact that man's knowledge of himself has not kept pace with his knowledge of the physical world. That right there, I mean, there's Vonnegut's insight and humor just packed into one sentence.
But he embroiders it because the next thing you find out is Gramps says, we said that 100 years ago,
yes.
too.
Nothing's
and it's
new.
True. This seems to be a consistent problem. We can't quite get an answer to
right,
that.
Right, wrap our hands around and so here he's tapping into this fundamental aspect of being human and not one of the great fundamental, you know, that maybe we need to engage in more moral reflection and introspection and really start to try to understand ourselves, not just looking externally and trying to conquer and dominate the world and nature.
Right. And if you're living in an apartment with 20 odd other people, that's going to be especially difficult.
Right. Now, Vonnegut in the story doesn't tell us how many people there are in the world, but he does give us a little bit of an insight, because a couple paragraphs after the one I just read, the commentator is talking about a special celebration in Chicago at Chicago's Lyon Inn Hospital, because the guest of honor is a brand new baby boy who is the 25th millionth child to be born in the hospital. And when you start to think about that, that just is in one hospital. So
yeah,
we're in a pretty overcrowded world in this story.
We are. And his whole point is that we've managed to be so successful in doing what we've done in the care and feeding of people that now there are way too many of them.
Right. Now, the sort of the main characters of the story, if you can go so far as to say that, are Emerald and Lou. Lou is the grandson of Gramps Ford. Gramps apparently has amassed his fortune and has the only bedroom in the apartment. He also gets the better food. And Lou sort of missteps at one point in time, and Gramps decides to disinherit him from the will, which, of course, has happened over and over and over again. And so a lot of the story is about...
He's had a lot of years, and he's used many of the extra ones crafting his will over and over.
Right. Let me give our listeners an excerpt from the story, and then maybe we'll let our listeners... It's a very short story. They can read it for themselves, and we can move on to Chekhov and the Bet. So this is from Vonnegut's The Big Up Yonder. On Gramps' bureau was his will, smeared, dog-eared, perforated, and blotched with hundreds of additions, deletions, accusations, conditions, warnings, advice, and homely philosophy. The document was, Lou reflected, a 50-year diary, all jammed onto two sheets, a garbled, illegible log of day after day of strife. This day, Lou would be disinherited for the 11th time, and would take him perhaps 6 months of impeccable behavior to regain the promise of a share in the estate, to say nothing of the daybed in the living room for M and himself.
Ah!
So the Big Up Yonder with Vonnegut, as you were saying, PT, it's an early Vonnegut story, but it really shows the brilliance that Vonnegut had, not in just crafting his stories, but in his thoughts and his commentary and how he delivered them.
Absolutely. There are premonitions, shall we call them, of some of his later, more better known works here that just stand out. It's a great story to read to maybe ease yourself into Vonnegut's world.
Yeah, absolutely. He also captures, even though we don't get a lot of character development in the story, we get some, and he also really captures, I think, family dynamics well.
That's the key right there.
Right. As Gramps is, finally gets a pen from one of his many descendants, "I've had many heartbreaks ere leaving this vale of tears for a better land," Gramps said and wrote, "but the deepest hurt of all has been dealt me by..." He looked around the group, trying to remember who the malefactor was. Everyone right. Looked helpfully at Lou, who held up his hand resignedly. So a very different story, but also very similar, is Chekhov's The Bet.
Yes. And this covers almost the reverse, because what we have here is a man going off and being by himself for 5 years.
Right, and it is a short story. It's only about 40 paragraphs. Chekhov, of course, is sort of known as the father of the modern short story.
Right.
And you get all of that packed into this very short amount of space. It's a story that can be read, in just one little sitting if you just want a break from your day. But as you were saying, PT, the content of the story, or the underlying philosophical question of the story, is not something that is just happy-go-lucky.
No, not at all. And because he was so brilliant at it, Chekhov framed the story to be totally explicable and part of Russian society. Now, this was written in 1915, I think.
I originally had 1889, but I can't. We'll have to double check.
It's old. It's old school.
Yeah.
You have a bunch of people standing around at a party, all of them well provided for, unlike many of the rest of the Russians, talking about somewhat ethereal things.
Right. A question that we are continuing to talk about today and still do not have, I think, a full answer to.
No, we don't. The whole idea of imprisonment.
Yes. And capital, and the question of capital punishment.
And capital punishment.
Right. Is capital punishment an okay thing? Should the state take away life? Right.
Right.
Is that appropriate? Is it moral? And at this party, and we don't get any insights, and we actually get very little insights into this story in terms of the setting and the characters. It's mostly just to hear the facts one after the other.
Yeah.
Very little description even of the environment until toward the end. But at this party that had happened 15 years ago, you had people saying, look, you know, capital punishment is the worst thing that you could do. And another individual at this party saying, no, life imprisonment is far, far worse. Capital
right.
punishment takes away a life immediately. Life imprisonment takes away a life very, very slowly.
Right.
And so the banker who's hosting this party and the lawyer who is attending this party get into this debate over who is correct. And they're engaging in these a priori mm-hmm. discussions, right?
And I think this has something to do with what I was trying to get at before. Discussing capital punishment in Russia in the late 1880s was a completely theoretical exercise because there was absolutely no way what people thought of anything would get anywhere unless the czar happened to think the same thing.
Right, a very different setting.
So people tended to come up with these theoretical things and embroider them fantastically.
Yes.
And what happens is the flamboyance of one of the banker leads to the flamboyance of the lawyer, or maybe vice versa, I don't know. But they go out at each other with the same amount of passion that anybody does who knows that whatever they say won't matter.
Right. And they're both young. They're young, vibrant men. The banker is very wealthy. The lawyer has a long career ahead of him. In this short story, Chekhov, again, doesn't tell us what to think. He doesn't say this is the right way, this is the right. He really leaves it up to ourselves, except there is one little insight from Chekhov where the banker and the lawyer have decided they're going to make this bet. The banker says to the lawyer, okay, well, if you think that, you know, life imprisonment is the route to go, well, I bet 2 million rubles that you cannot, you know, stay in solitary confinement more or less for 5 years. And the lawyer says, aha, I'll do you one better. Let's make it 15 years. And that's their bet. Chekhov tells us, so this wild, ridiculous bet came to pass.
Yes.
So we do know what Chekhov thinks of this bet, right?
Well, this is conflicting passions that people actually wind up trying to honor instead of recognizing them as impassioned theory.
Right, right. And even the banker, you know, after the lawyer accepts this bet, the banker starts to pace from corner to corner. And the story opens 15 years later. Right. So the bet has, you know, and the lawyer has been in confinement for 15 years, and the banker pacing from corner to corner recalled all this and asked himself, why did I make this bet? What's the good? The lawyer loses 15 years of his life and I throw away 2 million rubles. Will it convince people that capital punishment is worse or better than imprisonment for life? No, no, all stuff and rubbish. On my part, it was the caprice of a well-fed man, on the lawyer's pure greed and gold. So Chekhov here is sort of intimating that, you know, we probably won't get an answer about capital punishment or life imprisonment through this bet, but he's after something even beyond those questions.
Yeah. I think the banker here may be doing the lawyer a disservice.
Yes, I think
so,
too.
If it was just about the money, he probably wouldn't have done it.
He wouldn't have done it,
But he has other things involved.
Yeah. And so the story goes very quickly, and we get an insight into how the lawyer is spending his time, but really, even though the story isn't told from the first person perspective of the banker, we only get the banker's perspective. So it's a very interesting way of crafting this story. Even though there's sort of this omniscient narrator, really we are only seeing things through the banker's side.
Right. And they had set out the comforts that the lawyer would be allowed. And in the first part of his term, he rejects most of them.
He does. And why
no
so?
No tobacco.
Yes.
No wine.
Right? Yes. I don't know how many of us in our pseudo-quarantines are doing the same thing, but I found that very interesting. And why no? Well, no tobacco because the smoke would fill his only space with, you know, acrid smells. But why wine? Why did he give up wine, at least in the beginning?
I would say that he did it simply to... His mind had cleared, and he wanted to keep it that way.
Right. Now, we do get a little insight from the lawyer. Wine, he wrote, excites desires, and desires are the chief foes of a prisoner. Besides,
yes.
Nothing is more boring than to drink good wine alone. But you're right, PT, because the next stage that he goes on to, so he does have books, and the first books that he reads are sort of, you know, feel-good books. People have called them sort of like beach reading. But after that, just what you were saying.
He goes deeper.
He learns multiple languages. He starts studying philosophy.
Yeah. Right. And I think that's an important point. When you look at wine drinking, it's perfectly acceptable to go out to a restaurant, go to a party, have a wine with friends. But you know, if you're drinking a wine alone, people get this vision of a bum in an alley drinking really bad Muscatel.
The lawyer is right.
Yeah.
It's not much fun. PT, we are already at our halfway mark. So let's pause very briefly for station identification and a few announcements and let our listeners sip their wine if they're having it at midday or maybe their second cup of coffee.
This is WRUU-LP, Savannah, Georgia, 107.5 FM, WRUU.org. We are Savannah Soundings Community Radio with Global Soul.
Senior Citizens Incorporated is looking for volunteer Meals on Wheels drivers. A few hours each week will connect some of our area's most vulnerable residents with nutritious food and a regular knock on the door. For more information, contact Laura at 912-964-5411.
WRUU 107.5 FM is a new and different listener-supported and all-volunteer community radio station for Savannah. Our diverse broadcast and web programming is supported by generous listeners who value our passion and spunk. We are independent of other media and receive no government or large corporate support. People like you are the largest and most important source of our funding. Go to WRUU.org to find out how you can make a one-time or monthly contribution. Thank you.
Well, welcome back to Listening to Literature here on WRUU 107.5 FM. Today, PT and I are talking about three different but sort of similar short stories by some very well-known authors. PT, before the break, we were sort of talking a little bit about Chekhov's The Bet.
Right, we were. And the bet was that a lawyer could not remain in solitary confinement for 15 years on a wager of 2 million rubles.
Yes.
Because it was Chekhov.
It was Chekhov, of course. Yes.
Insofar as we've gotten, it's starting to look like he might actually do it.
Absolutely, right? And the interesting part of the story for me is, you know, because I couldn't live without books. I couldn't live without reading. The one thing that the jailed, the lawyer, does have access to his books. And he first starts out with easy reading, fun tales, things that can take you away from this world. Mm-hmm. Then he moves on to studying languages and philosophy and, you know, is very rigid about his learning and feels like he has learned everything there is to know in human history, right? And then he moves on to reading just one book for an entire year.
Yes.
And which book is that?
The Bible.
The Bible, right? Which really kind of mystifies the banker. You know, the banker says, you know, the banker found it strange that a man who in 4 years had mastered 600 erudite volumes should have spent nearly a year in reading one book.
Right.
Easy to understand and by no means thick.
Perhaps it is that you need a lot of preparation before you can begin to understand that
Absolutely.
Particular one.
And then after that, he moves on to just sort of this random assortment of reading, and I have to say, not that I'm at the same level, PT, but at this stage of the shelter at home, that's what I'm doing. You name the subject matter, oh, I'll read a book about that.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Mm-hmm. And now, toward the end of the story, the 15 years is almost up, and the banker is pretty darn nervous about this.
Well, he is, because while the lawyer has been in solitary confinement, the banker's business hasn't gone so well.
No, and the stock market hasn't really been so kind to him either. And now all of a sudden, 2 million rubles is
gone bankrupt.
Yeah, absolutely. He has probably more debts than he has money at this stage. And he has a dilemma. So what does he do? Here the lawyer is about ready to win this bet, and the banker knows that might be the end of his livelihood.
Right. And comes the day, he unseals the door.
Yes.
The banker does.
Right. Now, the interesting thing from a writing perspective, the only real description that we truly get of this environment is as the banker, during this storm, leaves his house to go to his garden wing,
mm-hmm.
this cottage, which is where the lawyer has been imprisoned.
Right.
We get very rich as we can get in this story, descriptions of the storm, of the banker walking from his house over to the garden wing.
Right. Little symbolism there, you think?
I think so, right? Oddly enough, it's a dark and stormy night is what it is.
Yeah.
But, of course, it's Chekhov, so Chekhov does it very, very
right.
well. And you're right, I think there's quite a bit of symbolism about what's going through the banker's mind.
Yeah, his mind is in absolute turmoil.
It
because
is.
Now he's sort of made a sucker bet that he can no longer honor.
Right. And here's this man who has given up 15 years of his probably most productive years, and the banker's pretty sure that the lawyer's going to come out of his, you know, imprisonment,
right.
and demand, you know, have his hand out, demand his 2 million rubles.
At any rate, the lawyer unseals the door, goes
the banker.
In. The banker, I'm
yep,
sorry.
I know. We don't have any names. It's
no.
just lawyer and banker.
Yeah. And finds a note.
Yes.
And here, I think, is where Chekhov really gets into some hard philosophy. I can't say it's stuff that he necessarily agrees with 100%.
Right.
But it's something that's kind of advanced for the 1880s right. or even 1915.
He's posing the questions.
Yes.
And leaving them to us to contemplate.
And they are to do with what you might call the meaning of life.
Yes, right. So again,
in all its variations.
Right, and really boils. So again, we were saying earlier, going beyond just the question of capital punishment versus life imprisonment, to really take a look at the difference between knowledge and experience. The lawyer in his note in part. Tells the banker, your books gave me wisdom. All that unwearying human thought created in the centuries is compressed to a little lump in my skull. I know that I am more clever than you all. So the question is the difference between knowledge, you know, what does knowledge give you versus what does experience give you? Here the lawyer feels like there's nothing that the world can teach him because he knows all this knowledge. He has it all in his skull, compressed down.
Right, but then go on. And I despise your books, despise all worldly blessings and wisdom. Everything is void, frail, visionary, and delusive like a mirage. Though you be proud and wise and beautiful, yet will death wipe you from the face of the earth like the mice underground, and your posterity, your history, and the immortality of your men of genius will be as frozen slag, burnt down together with the terrestrial globe. So on one hand, he's saying, hey, I got all this neat stuff from your books.
Right.
And the second thing he says is, I kind of don't care for it.
Right. It doesn't mean it. Because he goes on and he says, you are mad and gone the wrong way. You take life for truth and ugliness for beauty. Yeah. Yeah.
And then he gives up the $2 million.
Yeah. He has in this note told the banker that he doesn't want the $2 million, and therefore he is going to escape just a few minutes or so earlier before the bet is done, and basically give up what was rightfully due to him.
Right.
Now, this, of course, makes the banker pretty darn happy, because one of the things we didn't tell our readers is in that stormy walk from the manor house to his garden wing, the banker had thought to himself, well, the only thing I can do here is kill him.
Yes.
Right. One of the interesting things I also find about this story, which, again, there's not much to it in terms of the physical world that Chekhov creates in the story, but one of the objects in this world that is created is the letter itself. And other scholars have said, you know, what is this letter? Not only is the letter letting the banker off the hook, but the letter is actually saving the lawyer's life, whether the lawyer knows that or not.
That's true, but it's a very powerful statement of beliefs. Again, I'm not sure that they're necessarily Chekhov's beliefs.
They might not. No, I think he's just posing the questions for us.
I think he is, and I think they're questions that probably every person has to answer for themselves.
We grapple with likely every day, and we will continue to grapple with them. And Chekhov, as he is wont to do, won't wrap things up neatly for us. He doesn't necessarily give us any insight as to what happens, especially to the lawyer, after the end of the story.
All we know is the lawyer escaped.
Escapes to what? We don't know.
Yeah, that kind of interested me, because now that he's reached all these great conclusions, how does he go out in the world and live according to them?
Right, maybe he becomes the great ascetic, right? Or maybe he commits suicide. You know, you get sort of both of those senses. We also don't know what happens to the banker necessarily. Sure, his money is safe, at least for now, until the next stock market maybe takes it. But we also don't know if the banker engages in any moral reflection. Does the banker change? Here he was contemplating ending someone's life, right? Oddly enough, engaging in a sort of capital punishment after this poor man has been imprisoned.
Mm-hmm.
Not that it was a capital punishment that was, you know, that the lawyer had quote unquote earned. But we don't know if the banker changes his mind or becomes a better person or reflects on, you know, his past.
Yeah. Given what little we know of the banker, I don't think the banker changes at all. But my heavens, the lawyer has changed so much that it's really difficult to tell where he's going to go.
Right. We have a little bit better sense of the banker, I think in part because we are seeing the story alongside him. But also he hasn't gone through the same variety of changes that the lawyer has, even though the lawyer has only been in one little tiny space for 15 years.
Right. Sometimes big events do that to us.
Yeah, absolutely. I love Chekhov's stories. I love Chekhov's writing. He was so prolific. He could look at an object and go, okay, tomorrow I will write, a story about that the next day. Of course, he was also a physician, and some people have said that we're getting sort of this detached, objective gaze in this story, the way that what we would call maybe a modern physician that comes about in the United States in the early 1900s, a little bit earlier overseas on the continent, this detached gaze that sees the body and the disease as objects. We get a little bit of that sense here in Chekhov, but Chekhov is really interested in the human questions.
Yes, he is. And I don't know. It seems to me that I think that helps me a little bit.
Okay.
Because he's not pushing a set of views at you. It gives the reader the latitude to think about those things themselves.
Right, we're engaged. And this was very different from the other writing that was happening in Chekhov's time, particularly his immediate contemporaries, where these stories would be very moralistic and you would be pushed one way or the other. Chekhov doesn't do that.
Chekhov
hands it over to us to engage in the questions that he is raising.
Right.
Right.
Although in common with his era, he starts his story with the fact that it was a dark autumn night.
Exactly. So, P.T., our third short story, which is far longer than the first two, but still not so long that you couldn't, grab a cup of tea and find a nice sunny spot somewhere inside or outside and dig into it. This is The Jelly Bean.
It is.
By F. Scott Fitzgerald.
And it appeared in a book called Stories of the Jazz Age.
Yes. Tales of the Jazz Age, right?
Okay.
It might have been published under both.
Yeah. But Scott Fitzgerald in this took the opportunity to give a little preamble to each story.
To each story, yes. It's sort of this expanded table of contents.
Yes, uh-huh. Yes. This is what you're going to read about.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a story from Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
A place called Lily of Tarleton, Georgia. I don't know where that is.
We're a big state, PT.
We are.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. But if you want to read the story for local issues, one of the characters, one of the orbital characters, comes from Savannah, so we show up in there too.
Yes, we do, and it's always nice to see us in there.
And in his preamble, he mentions the fact that the game of dice appears in this story, and he knows nothing about dice. So he asked his wife, who is apparently pretty good at crap shooting.
Right.
She contributed her knowledge to the dice playing part of this, which is not a great deal, but it's part of that lovely atmosphere that Fitzgerald always sets.
Absolutely. And it really is the only action scene in the story.
It really,
if you can call it Rolling Dice action, but it really is an action scene. It comes later in the story. I think the story is in three different parts.
Right.
But yeah, in that little preamble from his table of contents, Fitzgerald writes that this story was written under strange circumstances shortly after my first novel was published. And moreover, it was the first story in which I had a collaborator. So there he is giving this nod to his wife, Zelda, who, of course, was a Southerner. Right, from Alabama.
Right.
Fitzgerald himself is a Northerner, although his father, I believe, came from Virginia. So Fitzgerald always had an interest in the South, and in part, and sometimes romanticized the South, and then later, of course, maybe took a more of a critique of it.
Perhaps, yeah. But what's material to this is there are some things that are so familiar to readers of Scott Fitzgerald. He specializes in that detached observer that you were talking about earlier. With Chekhov. And Scott Fitzgerald is a master at that.
He really is. But he does also weave in such depth and details. We get a richer sense of the environment and even some of the characters in the story. Of course, Chekhov was more than capable of doing that. It's just that in Chekhov's story, The Bet, that was not his point.
No, it wasn't at all.
So he chose differently.
In this one, and this, I think this is true for a lot of Scott Fitzgerald's work, that detached observer does a lot of different things, one of which is he provides the context for the reader. The detached observer in this, Clark, was it?
Jim Powell?
No.
So Jim Powell is the jelly bean.
The jelly bean. No.
Yeah, Clark is the
observer.
Yes.
Anyway, Clark provides you with all this background about the town and about Jim and about how things work and so forth.
Right.
He's the one who's setting the table for Jim's story to begin.
Right, because this really is a story about Jim, the so-called jelly bean.
Yes.
And of course, you know, you can look up jelly bean in the dictionary. It's not going to help you. You can think of, I think, you know, the first thought that comes to my mind is Ronald Reagan and a big jar of, you know, those delicious things that some of us
jelly
really like
bellies.
To eat. But this is not what Fitzgerald means. Fitzgerald helps his readers by explaining
what a jelly bean is.
Yes, in the second paragraph. Right. But Jim was long and thin and bent at the waist from stooping over pool tables, and he was what might have been known in the indiscriminating North as a corner loafer. Jellybean is the name throughout the undissolved Confederacy for one who spends his life conjugating the verb to idle in the first person singular. I am idling. I have idled. I will idle. In Fitzgerald's way, what a great description.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
What kind of verbs do we conjugate in our lives, P.T.?
Well, I hope not that one.
I hope not that. I mean, on occasion, it's a good one, right? On occasion.
Yeah.
But, you know, this is, Jim takes it to the extreme, right? And he had been involved in the war, right? He was in Charleston. He worked in the Navy Yard. And then he went to Brooklyn and worked in the Navy Yard there. He also came from a much wealthier family, but by the time he comes about, his family basically has lost
hard times,
and also he loses his father while he's still, I think, relatively young. So this is the setting in which Jim Powell has come to his jelly bean-ness.
They contributed to it, but there's something in Jim, I think, that is a much bigger contributor.
Yes,
it's easier for him when you talk about a protagonist of a piece of writing. Usually, people think of hero,
right? Someone we can root for.
Somebody we can root for, and Jim is anything but.
Jim is anything but. Yeah, he gets by. He has a little place above a garage.
He is a man who gets by.
Yeah.
limited interests, limited future. Mm-hmm. He's just kind of there. He's a jelly bean.
Right. Limited social interactions.
Very limited social interactions.
Because eventually Clark, who he and Clark, I guess, maybe grew up together, right? Says, Clark Darrow says, hey, you know, why don't you come to a party? And of course, it's a party with a lot of the people that Jim may have grown up with, but of course are in a different class than he is at this stage.
You get the sense of a class structure there too, don't you?
Yeah, of course. And that's something that Fitzgerald will continue to write about quite a bit. But some of Fitzgerald's writing, right? In the twilight of one April evening, when a soft gray had drifted down along the cotton fields and over the sultry town, he was a vague figure leaning against a board fence, whistling and gazing at the moon's rim above the lights of Jackson Street. His mind was working persistently on a problem that had held his attention for an hour. The jelly bean had been invited to a party.
Now, all of that, the story part is that he's been invited to party. But my goodness, the description that went into that.
Yes.
And it's so good.
Oh, it's so, so wonderful. And you get these nuggets all throughout this story.
You do. And this is something that Fitzgerald is very good about, even about less exotic places like Long Island.
Right. The other aspect of that you see of Fitzgerald's in this story, of course, is the Southern heroine. And that, of course, is Nancy Lamar.
Yes, right?
Old Nancy, who later, if I can find the quote, who later basically says, you know, don't treat me like a girl. I'm not like any girl you've ever seen. I'm paraphrasing that here until I can find the real quote. Mm-hmm. She is someone who lives life very largely and I think cares very little about
that's one way of putting it.
What others and society might think of her.
She certainly does not. Uh-huh. She certainly does not. And again, this is something I think that shows up in Fitzgerald's writing too. Again, the so-called heroine who you can't really quite figure out her thought patterns.
Right. Now, I was reading an article, a scholarly article last night, PT, that claimed that eventually Fitzgerald, a little later in his life, once he's 40, once Zelda is struggling with her own mental health issues, sort of gives up or abandons his heroines. But this is a much earlier story where and oddly enough, this is sort of the story is sort of a sequel because we do have a nod to a character in The Jelly Bean by the name of Sally Carrol, if I have that right.
Right.
She figures prominently in a story prior to The Jelly Bean called The Ice Palace,
right,
where the Southern woman meets a man from the North and moves up North and how she didn't really fit there. So so it's interesting. There's sort of a line of heroines in this story, even though we don't get much of that original heroine. It's much more about Nancy.
Yes. I believe that she was a convenience that he put in, Sally was.
Yes.
And there's no real relationship between the stories, except, of course, that Southern attitude and goes with the environment.
Right. So, I had that. Sally Carrol Hopper. Sally Carrol Hopper,
right.
From The Ice, and the reason why I was trying to remember both of the first names and to get them in the right order, because in The Ice Palace, Sally Carrol's mother-in-law calls her Sally, and she does not like that.
No.
Her name is Sally Carrol. But yes, there's I don't know if there was, you know, this is a true sequel per se. It's really just you get a sense of the same place and the same characters.
Right. What happens? I'll move it forward a little bit. Is the jelly bean goes to the party, and more or less collides with Nancy Lamar.
Yes.
And I was about to say they started a romance. I think the Jelly Bean thought they did. Nancy Lamar very definitely does not.
No, definitely does not. So the great Fitzgerald fashion, and also really layering these different social classes. The Jelly Bean, of course, doesn't want to dance. He doesn't really want to be at the dance. He goes outside at one point, and that's where he runs into Nancy Lamar because she's got gum stuck to the bottom of her shoe. And of course, she can't dance with gum stuck to the bottom of her shoe. And she's asking the Jelly Bean to help her, right? Don't you have something that can get this off? And they can't think of anything, and they're, the gasoline from the cars.
Yeah, so he siphons off some gasoline and takes care of that.
Right.
And then they have a little corn product.
Yes, because Clark has asked the Jelly Bean to hold on. We're talking about Prohibition era here.
Yes.
Hold on to his corn product. And Nancy, of course, said, you know what, that Clark, he promised me a highball. And the Jelly Bean says, well, I have some here. And Jelly Bean says, well, don't you want to mix it with ginger ale, as he and Clark were doing earlier?
Well, that's what a highball is. No, she apparently is quite comfortable with straight out of the bottle.
Right. And this, of course, leads into eventually this dice game. And the Jelly Bean might not have a lot of luck in other areas of his life.
Oh, but he's both lucky and accomplished when it comes to dice.
Absolutely. And Nancy is as well, although her luck, I think, is a lot spottier.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's how they get within further distance of each other. She has a run of bad luck, and he, in essence, bails her out.
Right. And this reinvigorates him. Jim experienced a quick pang of a weird new kind of pain. Some ray had passed between the pair, a shaft of beauty from that sun that had warmed him a moment since. The Jelly Bean felt suddenly like a weed in a shadow. That's a little earlier on in the story before they get to the craps game. But his interactions with this force of nature, and I think that's what Nancy Lamar should be described. She is a force of nature. Wakens something in him that, maybe he can think about what happens next and a future and what he might in his life.
He starts to do something other than thinking of the spur of the moment, and that's very unusual for him.
It's very unusual for him. And we won't ruin the end of the story for our listeners. But it's a great Fitzgerald story that Zelda had quite a hand in as well.
Yes.
And a little bit longer than the other two that we covered.
But very worthwhile, though.
Yeah.
Again, he is
still,
a master
of description.
You can read it in
one sitting. He is a master of description and capturing feelings and that fundamental human endeavor that we're all on.
Yes,
all right.
Very much so.
Well, Peachy, we are already at the top of the hour. I'm going to leave it there for our listeners. And we really want to thank all of you for listening to Literature here on WRUULP 107.5 FM. Stay safe and stay reading. The viewpoints expressed in the preceding program were not necessarily those of WRUU, its license holder, or its staff. This is WRUULP, Savannah, Georgia, 107.5 FM, WRUU.org. We are Savannah Soundings, community radio with global soul.